Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association podcast entitled Ethics of Filing for Asylum to Apply for Cancellation of Removal. I'm J.J. Area, AWA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Alan Goldfarb, the AWA Ethics Committee Chair from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Joining Alan are Matthew Blaisdell, the AWA Consumer Protection and UPL Committee Chair from Brooklyn, New York, Michelle Carney from Seattle, Washington, Megan Moore from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Victoria Nielsen from New York, New York. The speakers have carefully selected written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AWA Agora Digital Library. Go to agora.awa.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@awa.org. And at this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Alan.
Thank you, JJ. So we're fortunate to have four other panelists on the discussion, and these four panelists also co-authored the ethics advisory that AWA published on the same topic that came out November 1st. So the ethics advisory came out before the election, but the substance of the advisory is especially important now after the election and based on some developments that have happened more recently, including continuing announcements from yesterday and today about the immigration enforcement focus of the new administration. After the advisory came out, it received widespread distribution, not just among AWA members, but among government officials, and it was a welcome advisory because it talked about a real problem that has been noticed by people in the immigration court system and also other lawyers, and it reflects some desperation among the clients that we work with on pursuing different forms of relief. And the difficulty of getting into removal proceedings to apply for this form of relief called cancellation of removal for non-permanent residents. And after the advisory came out, it was cited in a Wall Street Journal article following the election. The article came out December 17th about immigrants using asylum applications to delay deportation. And in that article, the advisory was referenced for the fact that that there's been an increase in the number of asylum filings following the election of President Trump, and that may not have been so accurate, but at the same time, the article does a really good job of providing the different points of view on filing asylum applications that may not be as strong as we would like, really for different purposes, including for the ability to get work authorization, taking advantage of long backlogs in asylum offices and the immigration court system, and then also with work authorization, having protection and being able to get a Social Security number and a driver's license, which is really important. And it talked a little bit about the problem of attorneys who advertise for people to get 10-year work permits through this process, and the idea that clients may not exactly know what they're getting into when they're filing for asylum. And it also referenced the idea that you could file for asylum as a way of getting directly into deportation and then pursue this other form of relief that may be a stronger case for the client called cancellation of removal. So the goal of this podcast is really to talk about the practice of filing asylum applications that may not be as strong for different purposes, including to get work authorization, And also to be able to apply for this other form of relief called cancellation of removal. And we're going to talk about the ethics involved in making that decision on behalf of your client, with your client's permission on what to file. So we're going to, in this podcast for the next hour, we're going to go through different parts of the analysis. We're going to provide background on cancellation of removal, background on the standards for asylum and how they're different, considerations of different rules related to when the asylum application is frivolous, and other ethics rules that come into play. And then we're going to provide examples of cases where attorneys were disciplined for not doing things ethically and getting clients into big trouble. And then finally, we're going to end with some best practice advice on when it's possible to ethically file both types of applications and practices to follow to make sure that you're complying with ethics rules. So I'm going to start the substantive conversation by asking Victoria to talk a little bit about what cancellation of removal for non-lawful permanent residents is, what the standards are, and why it's necessary to go through the asylum process to be able to pursue that form of relief. So, Vicky, if you're able to provide some background, that would be great.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for the introduction, Alan. So for those of you who've been practicing for a long time, prior to 1996 when IRA was enacted, there was an easier route to lawful permanent residence for people who had been in the United States for a long time and who had, you know, positive equities and good moral character called suspension of deportation. And back in the 80s and 90s, it was relatively straightforward to bring a packet with all of the equities to the INS office and ask to be put into deportation proceedings so that that form of relief could be pursued. I mean, ironically, under the Obama administration, where there was an effort to prioritize removal proceedings for people who had criminal issues and national security issues, it was much more difficult to get into removal proceedings. As we move into the new Trump administration, we may find that it's very easy to get into removal proceedings, not that we will want that for our clients. I would also just say, you know, I think that we all understand that the sort of desperation that we as attorneys feel and that our clients often feel when there just isn't any easy route to get permanent residence here for people who've been living here their whole lives, have their families here, have their work here. But I think it's important to bear in mind that cancellation of removal was never really intended as a road to a green card. It was intended as a defense to removal proceedings for people who, you know, are on the path to being removed and can somehow convince a judge that their equities are extraordinary. So what are the requirements for cancellation? First, a person has to show that they've been physically present in the United States for 10 years. The burden is on your client to show that. So if they entered without inspection, you have to really have the evidence to show that they've been here for that length of time. Another important consideration is the stop time rule in cancellation cases. So if your client committed certain crimes, that stops the time. If your client was ever in immigration proceedings previously, that could stop the clock from ticking. It's from the moment that they get served with a notice to appear that the 10 years stop accruing. So your client may have been here for, you know, 20 years, but if they were served with a notice to appear, even if it was ultimately terminated, you know, within 7 years of coming to the United States, then they would not be eligible for cancellation. They have to show good moral character. So, you know, these are the usual equities showing that they have ties to the community, they support their family, they pay taxes. Again, you know, that can be challenging for some people to show that they pay taxes if they didn't previously have work authorization or social security number. You know, certain crimes knock people out of the realm of cancellation of removal, including felonies. And then the most difficult part is that they must show that their removal would result in exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to a spouse, parent, or child who's a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident. Again, this standard was intentionally meant to be much harder than the extreme and unusual hardship that was under the law for suspension of deportation. Courts have basically found that the usual, like, I'm not from this, my family's not from this country, it'd be hard to learn the language, the economy is not as good, I'd be separated from my family, those sort of ordinary hardships don't qualify. So in many situations, you really have to have some kind of medical issue or something else that sets your client apart from the, sort of quote-unquote regular hardship that anybody faces with deportation. And another thing that's just important to bear in mind is that there are only 4,000 visas allotted each year based on cancellation of removal. So even if your client wins in court, there's going to be a backlog of several years before they can actually get the green card. So you have to take into consideration if, for example, if the hardship is to a child, that if that child's approaching the age of 21, especially with backlogs in court, that there's a possibility that your child could age out before a visa becomes available. It's also just important to remember that under current rules, after you go through the whole hearing, you won't find out the result until there's actually a green card available. DHS is in the process of changing that rule so that if you lose, you will find out on the hearing date, meaning that at that time a removal order could be issued. So that's another thing to bear in mind. The problem is, even if you have a great cancellation of removal case and you think it's a strong case, how do you get your client placed into removal proceedings? And for that, maybe Megan can talk to us about the strategy that lawyers have been using.
Right. This is Alan. I just want to emphasize too that, just to be clear, these are very different forms of relief. And Vicki, you talked about the standard for cancellation of removal for non-permanent residents, and that's a pretty high standard to meet. But at the same time, are there cases where you just think this is a really good cancellation case, and you'd want to pursue that relief?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are cases where, if you have a person who, works hard, has no criminal issues, and they have, a U.S. citizen child with leukemia or who needs dialysis, and they come from a country where that kind of medical care just wouldn't be available, it can be obviously really life-changing to get somebody lawful permanent residence here who's otherwise undocumented, and it makes it much easier to provide the proper care and stability for that family member. So, I mean, there are situations where one can feel, pretty confident that it's a strong case. But as we all also know, anytime you end up in front of the immigration court, it's a bit of a roulette who the judge is, and what might be a slam dunk in front of Judge A might be a removal order in front of Judge B.
Thanks. Megan, I just want you to talk a little bit about why we're even discussing asylum applications. Why would that be a relevant topic for the idea that we want to try to get someone to be able to apply for cancellation of removal?
Absolutely.
And what is an asylum? What do you need to prove,
sure,
for asylum, and how is that different,
right,
from cancellation?
Right. Well, at a basic level, Vicki has talked about cancellation of removal as being a defense when you're in removal proceedings. Alternatively, asylum is a benefit you can seek affirmatively, meaning you don't need to be in removal proceedings. You can file an application for this benefit directly with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services while you are not or before removal proceedings have ever commenced. Asylum is a complicated and in-depth area of the law. There are books written about asylum and what you need to show to win asylum, and basically the applicant would need to be unwilling to prove that she is unwilling or unable to avail herself of the protection of her home country due to past persecution or a well-founded fear of being persecuted based on her race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. The fear here, this well-founded fear, must be both subjective and objective. And the subjective component requires a showing, the applicant really must show a genuine fear of persecution. The objective component comes in showing whether you have to prove whether a reasonable person in the applicant's circumstances would fear persecution. And that must be supported by credible, direct, and specific evidence. In addition to those requirements, you can't just apply for asylum at any time. There is a one-year deadline for filing for asylum from the time that you entered the United States. And there are limited exceptions to that one-year deadline. You have to either prove changed circumstances which materially affected your eligibility, the applicant's individual eligibility for asylum, or extraordinary circumstances related to that applicant's individual delay in the filing. So there are a lot of moving parts. This is not a simple one-page application that you file with USCIS. There, like I mentioned, are books written on this topic. There's books written on subtopics in asylum law. And I think you could probably write an entire book on what constitutes a particular social group in the context of asylum law. So things to keep in mind are that you're going to be working with people who potentially have been here for many years, and they don't necessarily have if they've been here 10 years or longer, they haven't filed an asylum application with 1 year. And so knowing those exceptions to the one-year filing deadline are going to be very, very important. Additionally, the requirement that the fear of be based on these your race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, that is in a particularly difficult, it can be a very difficult part of an asylum claim when it's not a simply I'm Christian and the country I'm from persecutes Christians. It can be much more involved than that. So attorneys need to be really, really able to analyze a case when it comes forward in terms of the requirements for asylum, and then apply it to that applicant's particular case. In terms of how this would actually get someone into removal proceedings, federal regulations actually require that should USCIS not approve the asylum application, that it refers the case to immigration court and puts the application in removal proceedings, assuming the applicant is inadmissible or removable. And the result is that the asylum applicant then is in removal proceedings in front of immigration court. That obviously allows the applicant to continue fighting the asylum case, but then it also opens the door to present any other relevant defense, which would include cancellation of removal for a non-lawful permanent residence. And that is really how it works logistically for someone to submit an affirmative asylum application who has the ultimate goal of getting into immigration court for the purpose of fighting a cancellation of removal application.
And I think it also should be emphasized, this is Alan again, that you're not going to get into removal proceedings right away if you file for asylum. The asylum office backlogs are significant and severe.
Correct.
Go ahead.
You could be looking at a 2 to 3 year interval from the time that you file your asylum application to when you would be scheduled for an interview with the asylum office that has jurisdiction over your case. So it's not an immediate it's not an immediate relief, and you need to think about that. So you're thinking about the asylum app requirements, but also for cancellation or removal, you have to think that this is a case that you may have not necessarily in 6 months, but in 3 years. And How might the applicant's circumstances change in 3 years to potentially impact the viability of the cancellation claim?
Thanks, this is Vicki. If I could, can I just jump in for 1 second on the backlog at asylum court? I mean, we've also heard of lawyers filing the quote-unquote 8-year visa, sort of counting on the 2-year backlog at court to accrue the 10 years, and I would just say we have no idea what the new administration is going to do, how they're going to prioritize, how they're going to hire, and,
right.
and counting on that backlog is, in my opinion, malpractice.
Right. And but it does make the idea more inviting of filing for asylum and you just have a long time to wait, even if it leads to malpractice, but that's the reason we're having this discussion now. There are asylum-specific rules on what constitutes a frivolous asylum application. So, Matthew, are you able to just summarize what those rules are and what the consequences would be?
Yeah, and in fact, in the advisory, we just basically cut and paste it. And it's pretty straightforward. It's fabricating information. That's the asylum-specific frivolous. So now a lot of the confusion when we talk about this issue is there's overlapping definitions of what is frivolous under the CFR and the model rules. Now, under the CFR, there's regular disciplinary sanctions that essentially track a lot of the definitions within the model rules. So there's, you know, ABA Model Rule 3.1, which addresses, I think, the definition of frivolous conduct. And then there's the asylum-specific one that's at a different section in the Code of Federal Regulations at 1208.20. So that carries with it very specific punishments, such as can be found at INA 208D6. And if a judge has found that you've made a frivolous application for asylum, the non-citizen, your client, will be permanently ineligible for any benefits under the Immigration and Nationality Act, which basically means almost everything, you know, arguably does not include Convention Against Torture, which is under, in theory, not a form of relief, deferral and withholding of removal, but pretty much everything else. And so if there's a finding that you've deliberately filed a fabricated claim, that's what you're subject to, and that's why the judges, you know, if you've ever filed an asylum claim in court, go to such lengths to, you know, read out the warning or ensure that you've made that warning to your client, the frivolous filing warning. If anything's fabricated, you're not going to be able to apply for anything pretty much ever as long as that finding is in the record. So
okay,
that is
Sorry, Matthew, so just to go through some scenarios that were outlined in the advisory. There was one hypothetical involving Yan Chen from China. She has a really good case for cancellation of removal, and she's been in the United States for 15 years and has a U.S. citizen son who has severe medical problems. Her attorney advises her to say that she recently converted to Christianity, and she files for asylum based on religious persecution or fear of religious persecution in China. And in fact, she's an atheist, so she's not a Christian. How would you analyze that scenario?
Sure.
Under the frivolous warnings, right?
In terms of scenarios, this one's probably the most clear cut. There's not a lot of gray here because, as Megan had gone over the elements, the essential elements for fleshing out an asylum claim, you're fabricating one of the essential elements. I mean, there's no doubt that this is material to the claim. That's what the whole claim is based on. So that's clearly going to trigger the attendant consequences in 208D6 for a frivolous filing. And then you also have to be aware for disciplinary purposes, and we'll go into this in a little more depth towards the end of the podcast, but you also have to consider, you know, Model Rules 4.1, truth-telling, and linking in 1.4, communication, whether you've effectively given the warnings to your client that if she makes this claim, not only if it's discovered will the application be dismissed, but she will not be able to apply for cancellation or anything else, and not just in proceedings at any point down the road. That includes before the court, USCIS, et cetera. And just to throw out other things you should be aware of, you know, Rule 1.2D under scope, you cannot counsel your client to engage in illegal or fraudulent behavior, fraud defined at Rule 1.0D, but I think we kind of know what that is.
So just to, sorry, Matthew, sorry to interrupt, but just to go through kind of the asylum-specific frivolous rules to distinguish, you know, the first hypothetical from the second one, which I'll read right now, and maybe for your comments on whether this second hypothetical would be a problem under the asylum-specific frivolous finding rules. So Gretchen is from Germany. She doesn't like Syrian refugees coming into Germany, and she thinks that they may cause violence, and so she wants to apply for asylum because she's afraid to return to Germany. And she's been in the United States for 14 years and has U.S. citizen children who might make her eligible for cancellation of removal. Would that be a frivolous application under the asylum-specific frivolous rules?
Right. This hypo provides a very good distinction from the last one. The last one is very clear-cut and asylum-specific frivolous. This one is closer to the model rules definition, which has a corollary in the CFR, but that's different. This one does not carry the same consequences. It's just a regular, you know, ethics problem. And so that is non-asylum, you know, regular civil practice frivolous, which is lacking a basis in law and fact. You're not making anything up. You know, you're coming out there and saying, you know, Gretchen doesn't want to stay in Germany because she doesn't like refugees. That's, you know, arguably lacking a basis in law and fact, but you're not misstating a material fact. You're not creating anything. And that's really what they're looking for when they attach the very strict consequences of preventing you from ever applying for anything again. That's not what they're talking about in this circumstance.
Okay.
This is just a borderline, everyday, vanilla, frivolous complaint.
So just to move on for Vicky, for this hypothetical involving Gretchen from Germany, is it then okay to file her asylum application? Would you do that as an attorney? Are there other considerations?
No. Yeah, there definitely are other considerations. So, right, I mean, I think people get confused about, because frivolous basically has two different meanings under the CFR, and I think some practitioners feel like, well, as long as I'm not lying in the asylum application, there's no problem in filing. And I think some of us have even seen, sort of as we've gotten FOIAs back, you know, that a lawyer will just write in something like cancellation of removal in the essay questions on the asylum application rather than completing them. The ABA model rule on meritorious claims and the 8 CFR 1003.102 say that a practitioner engages in frivolous behavior when he or she knows or reasonably should have known that his or her actions lack an arguable basis in law or in fact. So in this situation, you know, Gretchen may in fact have a real subjective fear and not be fabricating anything, but we as lawyers need to understand the asylum rules and analyze the case and know that someone from Germany is not going to win asylum and doesn't even have a reasonable basis to make an argument for asylum based on her fear of refugees there.
And remember, as pointed out by Megan, I think that fear has to be both subjective and objective. So you want, again, as Vicky was alluding, if it's not objectively reasonable, you can't find a basis for law. In fact, for that, it would be civil 3.1 frivolous.
Right. So that's a good point, Matthew. So Gretchen might really be afraid to go back to Germany, but that might be a subjective fear. But whether it's objectively reasonable is another consideration.
Right, and obviously, even if she's not subject to the extreme penalties of a frivolous asylum finding, which Matthew is talking about, basically, I think Matthew mentioned that people could still get relief under the Convention Against Torture. They can also still get withholding of removal if they've filed an asylum frivolous case, although obviously, you know, that wouldn't apply to Gretchen, who doesn't have an objectively reasonable fear of returning to Germany.
And the standards for withholding of removal are similar to asylum, so even though that's theoretically possible, it may not be so practical to think that you might be eligible for withholding if you're not eligible for asylum, if you can't prove an asylum case.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a situation where, you know, a client fabricated a material fact when working with a notario, but did in fact have a reasonable, you know, had a strong claim of persecution, and that basically the fact that he had committed fraud and fabricated a material fact knocked him out of the realm of asylum and into the realm of withholding.
So the next hypothetical, and this is the last one we'll talk about today, would be kind of maybe to distinguish Gretchen's situation, where maybe it's not such a good asylum case to pursue based on ethics rules, even if it might not be frivolous under the asylum-specific frivolous rules. The third hypothetical involves Veronica, who's from El Salvador, and she's afraid to return to El Salvador because of gang violence there, and she also has young daughters who she fears may be harmed by gangs who are active in El Salvador. She's a single mother, and she has five U.S. citizen children, and three of them have severe medical problems, and they require hospitalization and other monitoring. And her children are between 16 and 20 years old. So this would be another situation. How would you proceed with the analysis on whether to go forward with this asylum case?
Sure. So, I mean, first, she has a subjective fear, and I think anyone who does a little bit of research into country conditions in El Salvador would determine that her fear is objectively reasonable. So I think as long as she's being truthful, there's no problem whatsoever with the, you know, asylum-specific frivolous issue. Then you have to ask yourself, is there a basis in law, in fact, for her to file this? And, you know, there certainly is. Asylum is a constantly evolving area of law. And, you know, if you look at, for example, domestic violence-based particular social groups, for many years, those cases were losing, and the case went, you know, to the BIA and then was certified to the AG and then went back to the BIA. So I think especially in a lot of the cases that we're all seeing in our practices from Central America, what the law is today might not be the law 2 years from now or 10 years from now, and it could get better or it could get worse. But I think as long as you can, in good conscience, make an argument to extend the law, you are well within the ethical rules.
Thank you. That's helpful. So I'm going to ask Michelle to talk about other considerations. So once we've decided, you know, that an asylum application isn't frivolous under the asylum-specific rules, and there's a good faith basis to, even if it might not be a clear-cut asylum case, there may be a good argument to extend the law and to pursue the case. Are there other ethics rules that apply in this situation? So we've talked about people thinking that they're going to be applying for this 10-year work card, or, you know, a work authorization card that will be valid for a long period of time. What sort of communication do you have with a client to make sure that they understand what they're doing if you're submitting an asylum application? What's required of the lawyer?
So there's basically four rules that you have to pay attention to, and they kind of go hand in hand with each other. One is Rule 1.0E, the scope of representation, informed consent. Then there's 1.1, competence, 1.3, diligence, and 1.4, communication. Rule 1.0E and 1.4, communication, the scope of representation, informed consent, and communication really go hand in hand. And 1.1, competence, and diligence, 1.3, go hand in hand. Under 1.0E, the scope of representation, that really talks about your fee agreement and your written fee agreement and your oral communication to the client. And in your agreement, you need to lay out the proposed course of conduct and communicate the risks and possible alternatives to the client. That should be in a language that they understand. And you also need to have an in-person meeting with your client in a language that they understand and really go into depth about the case strategy and what you're intending to accomplish, getting into as much detail as you think they'll understand. I don't think you need to go into really deep legal minutia because that can confuse the client, but you need to make sure that they completely understand that this is not a strategy just to get a green card, that you actually are filing a meritorious asylum claim and, you know, possibly down the line, a cancellation of removal claim. So you really need to communicate under 1.4. And 1.4 basically says that you need to explain the process to the client so that they reasonably understand to the process, to the extent that they reasonably necessary to permit the client to make an informed decision. So again, those two really go hand in hand. And then with competence and diligence, under 1.1 competence, you need to have the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation of the case. And diligence basically talks about promptness. You must act with commitment and dedication to the interest of the client. So basically, what those two areas mean, you need to be really, you need to have in-depth legal knowledge on your claim, your client's claim of asylum. Asylum is a complicated area. It can rapidly change. You need to be familiar with circuit case law, BIA decisions, and anything as it relates to your client's claim for asylum. You also need to be familiar with cancellation and the case law as it changes in that area as well. And you need to keep current with the case law as time progresses, because if you file the asylum claim, it may be years before your claim is heard, and then years down the line for a removal case. So you need to continually keep the client informed, keep yourself updated on case law. And with respect to the diligence, you need to have procedures in your office so that applications are submitted on time. You have regular status checks on the case, on the case law, and you're communicating those back to the client.
Thanks, Michelle. And that's an important thing to think about, too, because these cases take a long time, and with the backlogs even longer, and you may be presenting a case that may not be as complete as you would hope when it comes time for a decision and add to it later on. So you have to be able to keep track of filing deadlines and other things to make sure that it's complete. Michelle, I'd like to ask you just one other follow-up question. Do you have any extra obligation to the client if you're following the strategy of maybe filing an asylum case that may or may not be the kind of the primary basis for the relief, if you're thinking that you want to pursue asylum to get the client into removal, to apply for cancellation of removal? What type of additional obligation do you have to communicate with a client about that strategy?
I think that you need to explain the risks to the client. You need to explain that, you know, they will go into removal proceedings, that once they're in removal proceedings, and I think that somebody else said this earlier in the discussion, that you may have one immigration judge on a cancellation of removal case that would grant your case based upon the hardship and another one that would deny your case. So it's a long road, and you need to explain to the client that even if you think they have the perfect case under the current case law, it may end up, the risk to the client may eventually be removal from the U.S. And so they need to thoroughly understand that when they start this process, the case law may change, policies under the current administration may change, and that they may end up getting removed. And they just really, it's like a doctor who gives, a diagnosis on potentially cancer. You know, this could be the end result for you, and do you want to proceed and go forward knowing that this serious risk of harm could happen to you?
Thank you. So, Megan, I just wanted to ask you to follow up on one other really important consideration. So if you find out that an asylum application is being presented, but some of the facts are misstated or inaccurate. What is your obligation as an attorney, both with the asylum office and then if you're in court later on?
Hey, Alan, this is JJ. I think Megan's having some technical difficulties, so we're going to try to work it out and get her back in the conference, but maybe I'm sorry for now. Maybe if you could move on to something else or
come back
later.
Yeah, so why don't we, Matthew, if you're available to talk just a little bit about some of the situations where people have gotten into trouble for following the strategy of filing for asylum to seek cancellation of removal, where there may not be a good asylum case and the communication may not be as strong. Are there examples of people getting into trouble for this and what happens to them?
Yeah, they have. And let me just introduce one or two more rules before we get into that discussion, because it'll help kind of explain things a little better. Alan, as you alluded to, the backlogs for the asylum office and the immigration courts have significantly increased, in part as a result of these practices, and as such can be treated as prejudicial to the administration of justice. So you have to think about Model Rule 8.4 for misconduct, which is taken pretty seriously by the disciplinary bodies. So, you know, we're usually, in that instance, not talking about somebody filing one single case, which, you know, is arguable one way or the other. You know, when we're talking about conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, we're talking about people who are doing this in terms of making it a pattern in practice. And as I think we all know, a lot of firms are kind of turning this into their business model and baking it into their whole way of doing business. And that's what really kind of perks the ears up of discipline, the practice of filing these cases en masse for purposes of getting NTAs. And also, I want attorneys to be aware of potential criminal liability, which we talked to, but that loops back to the definition of frivolous. So if you look at, in the advisory, we flesh it out a little bit, 18 U.S.C. 1546, fraud and misuse of visas, permits, and other documents, tracks that civil, you know, model rule definition of frivolous, lacking a basis in law and fact. And once you put such an application in the mail, you're also triggering 18 U.S.C. 1341 for mail fraud, and both of those are predicate offenses for RICO, 18 U.S.C. 1961. So I don't think those charges have ever been brought in such a case, but it's possible. And if you're doing this on a broad enough scale, that's on the table. But to answer your question directly, yes, several attorneys have actually been disbarred for this practice. And we do talk a little bit about that in the advisory, but let me describe some of those cases right now. The first one, I'm not going to give the name, but it's in the advisory. The attorney told a lot of potential clients that they'd have to go before a judge to obtain an employment authorization document and LPR status. So, you know, you guys came off the street. How do I get a work permit? How do I get a green card? And he told them, okay, sure, here's how you get both of those. You just have to go before a judge to get it. So, and then he just started filing 589s without explaining even on the face of the application, why they were not time-barred, and these applications were not supported by the specific and credible evidence that Megan talked about earlier, didn't have any details or facts in support of the asylum claim. And then when the clients came to him after they were filed, he told them to just skip the asylum interviews. So this is a strategy that entailed the filing of an application for non-LPR cancellation of removal. And then once they would get into court, he would then just ask for administrative closure, which would allow them to continually renew their work permits while the case is indefinitely off the calendar. And so as far as they know, this guy just submitted an application for an employment document, and they have it, and they can just keep working. They very well might not have known that anything related to asylum or cancellation of removal was filed. So the way this got flagged was the immigration judge would question the aliens when they came in, and the clients all told the judge that they didn't know why they were in removal proceedings. They told the judge that they were instructed not to appear for the interviews, and that they were not made aware of the consequences for failing to appear at the interviews. So the Office of the General, basically the immigration judge, referred the cases to the Office of General Counsel, who found that the applications were without merit and could be deemed frivolous by an immigration judge. They basically made findings of the practices we described that resulted in their being placed in removal proceedings and being subject to ultimate removal from the U.S. to the very country that they allegedly feared returning. So General Counsel found that the attorney had engaged in an inaction that seriously interfered with the adjudicative process, which the practitioner should have reasonably known to avoid. So that's what we're talking about with 8.4 misconduct. And that the attorney affirmatively placed the immigrants on the radar of government who were not previously known to the government and who were not previously in imminent jeopardy of being removed from the U.S. So they had found he had violated the civil definition for frivolous that we had talked about, and that can be found at 8 CFR 1003.102J. That's the provision under the regs that tracks the model rule definition of frivolous. Again, we're not talking about the asylum-specific one. So, and you can be busted for that. So, and also for engaging in conduct prejudicial the administration of justice, it's also in the CFR, and for lacking competence. All of these model rules also have their corollaries in the Code of Federal Regulations in the immigration context. And so General Counsel also cited to the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, found for lack of competence, lack of candor, failure to maintain personal integrity, false statements and misrepresentation, and general abuse of the legal process. And for that, he was disbarred. Now, again, these are pretty egregious examples, and they're not, as we know, this practice is widespread to the extent that they are not looking to refer to discipline. I mean, judges are not looking to refer to discipline every single case that comes up like this, but this is the kind of, it's an example of what can happen. Another being the example discussed in the advisory is an attorney who advised clients to file 589s for work permits and to get green cards without having to leave the U.S. So that's how he described it. It almost sounds like a stateside waiver, but it, in fact, it's what he's talking about is affirmatively filing asylum. And then he did file the 589s affirmatively without any details and also instructed his clients to skip the interviews. And again, when the cases got to court before the immigration judge, the attorney withdrew the applications and filed the 42Bs for non-LPR cancellation. And again, General Counsel found, cited to the ABA standards, lack of competence, candor, failure to maintain personal integrity, fraud, and abuse of the legal process. This guy had also done a whole lot of other stuff which got him in hot water. But now we've got a pattern of the EOIR, Office of General Counsel, disciplining attorneys for engaging in this conduct on multiple occasions. So the issue is how strong they're not, and again, they're not looking for people who are filing the kind of borderline claims that we talked about earlier, maybe in hypo number two, and certainly not in hypo number three. But you have to at least have a colorable application for asylum, a basis in law and fact, which is a pretty low bar. And I think, in my opinion, they do give attorneys a fair amount of leeway in that regard, and that they're not going after attorneys who are making creative one-year bar claims where they clients might also have compelling applications for withholding or for cancellation of removal. So there's a fair amount of freedom and space to work with in terms of protecting yourself from discipline. But if you do this enough, and depending on the judge whom you might be before, in terms of risk management, these are things that you have to be aware of. So, you know, the point of the advisory is to outline all the various rules involved and help attorneys manage their risk. All that said, I do think this, as we said, that because of the backlogs and such, this is beginning to be taken very seriously by discipline, and I think the courts are kind of engaging in review processes and screening these cases out. So there might be a heightened awareness, a heightened risk of cases getting referred. So we do, as attorneys, want to be a little more careful about managing our risk, perhaps, than some of us were before.
And I think that's a really good point to make at the end, because there is a heightened awareness of this problem, and judges are going to take action if they perceive that the system is being abused in the way that you've described, especially with these, you know, these two examples of attorneys who have been disciplined for the practice. You may get your client into big trouble, and the strategy of pursuing cancellation may not be available to the client if you file an asylum application that you don't really intend to pursue.
And also, as recording this podcast today with a new administration, new policies for chief counsel, he may not be following the Johnson memos anymore in terms of exercising PD. You know, for the examples we just gave, you know, where the attorneys were telling clients, you know, I'm going to get you the work permit and you'll just be able to work, because their strategy was asking for admin closure. It very well may be that form of prosecutorial discretion will not be around going forward to the extent that it has been in the past. So these cases very well might end up with removal orders shortly after they're referred to immigration court. And then you're going to have issues, because quite often when cases are referred to discipline, those referrals are made from successor counsel. So if, you know, people are walking around with removal orders looking for new attorneys to help them out, someone comes to me, I see what the old attorney did, I may be tempted to pass that along to discipline. So the strategy of seeking, you know, admin closure, clients are going to be out with working permits, you know, there's no victims, nothing ever is going to happen, that strategy might not be viable anymore.
Well, thanks, Matt. So is Megan back on the call?
I am here.
Okay, hi, Megan.
I am, thank you.
we lost you for a bit, but you're back, and you're back in time. We So Matthew has gone through some of the examples of situations where people have been disciplined, and also some of the considerations for what attorneys should be worried about in extreme cases. But a more common scenario might be, what does the attorney do if you find out, after you've taken over a case, for instance, that there are problems with the asylum case? And we've had one hypo where the attorney told the client from China to really make up facts in her asylum case about her religious beliefs.
Right.
What's the attorney supposed to do when you're already involved in a case like that that's been filed?
Well, this is really triggering our duty of candor to the tribunal. And the model rule here is 3.3. But obviously, as we've said throughout this podcast, you need to refer to your own jurisdiction's rules. For candor to the tribunal, the law at a basic level says that the lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal, or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by the lawyer. And then it goes on to say that the lawyer shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. One thing you have to keep in mind, and which Matthew spoke about, is that there are disciplinary sanctions regarding these types of actions. So 8 CFR 1003.102 would subject attorneys to disciplinary sanctions if they knowingly or with reckless disregard make false statements of material fact or law, or willfully mislead the tribunal relating to the case. So what it's saying is you cannot offer false evidence. But then if you later discover that evidence is false, so in the case which Matthew mentioned, if you come across a case that was filed affirmatively as an asylum application, comes to you in removal proceedings, that would be a time where you are required to review the evidence that was previously submitted and will be submitted moving forward in the case in front of EOIR. You need to review that evidence, and then if you find and if you know, come to know that it is not correct or true, you need to be making reasonable remedial measures to correct it while maintaining So the goal here is to maintain client confidentiality and balance your duty of confidentiality to the client with your duty of candor to the tribunal. One thing to be aware of, and you need to really, again, look at your own jurisdiction's rules here, is how your jurisdiction's rules balances confidentiality with candor to the tribunal. In some states, candor trumps confidentiality, and in other states, the confidentiality requirement cannot be violated. So, again, we can't really stress enough that you should be looking at your own jurisdiction's rules, because it will really dictate your how you should be moving forward when you come across a situation like this. In terms of the candor to the tribunal duty that you have, what we're really looking at here is knowledge, and knowledge of a false statement or a fact that's not true, a falsehood, an alternative fact is critical, I would say. And going back to the hypos, Matthew spoke about this, and Alan mentioned it too, but Yen, the first hypo we talked about, Yen Chen from China, if she tells you she's an atheist and yet you file an application stating that she's a Christian, you obviously know that you are submitting false information to USCIS and will later go in front of the court with that information. And a lot of times knowledge is actually not that black and white. Compare that with what you would do if Yen Chen tells you she's a devout Christian and then she drops her atheist card from her wallet or something along those lines. It probably wouldn't happen that easily, but that just is giving you an example of an action by the client or information that you may glean that may trigger your duty to dig a little bit into the client's, into the facts the client has presented to you, her story, and the evidence she even brings to you in your office. If, you know, she has a police report and it looks like it was made in someone's basement, then, you know, you need to take some reasonable steps to evaluate that and how and whether you should be submitting it. So as I said, this is going to come up if you come across a case that it is now in removal proceedings that was submitted originally and the application was filed originally by another attorney. You need to have a way to vet those cases and look at the individual facts and pertaining that under that make up the asylum claim for that client. Don't assume that because that application was filed that the content is true. And that obviously is the same with when you are filing an affirmative asylum application, knowing that it likely will be referred to court. You need to have a proper way to vet those cases before they're filed and vet the client and the facts that you're presented with from the client. Think about an in-depth face-to-face interview and look for additional evidence that the client could provide you to support what they're saying.
And that's also, Megan, just a good practice, too. You're preparing the client for for testimony before an asylum officer or before the judge, that and it would be subject to cross-examination. So you want to make sure that your client's testimony stands up and that they're able to explain in a way that makes sense to you as the attorney, that they're telling the truth and that they're able to answer more specific questions. And so part of just the case preparation as well, I would think.
Right. I want to also bring up the idea of a tribunal. This is really a million-dollar question, and it certainly is beyond the scope of this podcast, whether USCIS is a tribunal. Again, we are going to encourage you to look at your jurisdiction's own rules, but for our purposes here, talking about a case that will ultimately be referred to immigration court, be before EOIR, then you are going to have a tribunal involved, so you can't in a time when Rule 3.3 or your state's version of that is triggered. There are some good materials about what a tribunal is, and Alan, you could maybe mention tell everyone where they could find the Ethics Compendium for a good discussion about that.
Right, so the AILA Ethics Compendium is a resource that's available for free to AILA members, and there is a chapter on Rule 3.3 that provides more detailed information, and that's available through AILA on Agora. So that's a good resource to consider. Just to wrap things up, and getting back to Vicky, I want to just ask you after this discussion, is it possible to file an asylum application if the goal is ultimately to pursue cancellation of removal? Is that ethical? Are there ways that you can pursue both applications?
Sure. So, I mean, it's certainly ethical to pursue two forms of relief at the same time, or have a strategy that you might have alternate forms of relief. But I think from everything we've talked about today, you can't file for asylum if you as a lawyer know that you have no arguable ground for seeking asylum for your client. You can't file that application solely to get your client into removal proceedings and pursue cancellation. And I think it's really important for all of us to think of ourselves and our role in the immigration system. The asylum system is going to be under attack. It's already under attack from the new administration. And any role that we play in undermining the system just feeds into that notion that, you know, all of asylum seekers or, you know, all asylum applications are fraudulent. If we are filing applications that we don't even believe in, we're making it that much easier to undermine the system. You know, that being said, as we talked about, if you have an asylum case where you're not so sure that it's going to win, you feel pretty sure it's not going to win, but you explain all of the risks and benefits to your client, and your client truly has a fear of returning, and you feel that in good faith you can make an argument for why that client's fear should fit within asylum if the law is extended, then you can file and discuss with your client that the stronger form of relief would be cancellation and sort of what the likely steps will be after the asylum interview and going into court. But, you know, I think the most important things to remember are, you know, that you have to have a real belief that there's a possibility for the claim. And really important just to discuss everything with your client. Make sure they understand that they're going to be put into removal proceedings. Make sure they understand what the challenging legal standards are, and that you have their sign-off on this strategy.
And I think it's also important to make sure that you have the regular status checks in your office so that you can be continuously checking the case law, checking the the government's policies on these cases, and then informing the client along the way about what's new and what's changed. And if you have to, withdraw the application at some point in the future, you may have to make that decision as well.
And that's a really good point, because as a practical matter, I mean, a lot can change during the time that this case is pending, and what may be a good asylum case at the beginning may not be at the end, and it can go the other way as well. We're close to running out of time, and I just want to point out, too, that the advisory, the written advisory that is part of the materials for this podcast, really provide an excellent resource. And at the very end, there are some practice pointers that are really especially helpful in like a checklist in deciding when it's possible to pursue this asylum application if the purpose is really ultimately to seek cancellation of removal, and there are questions that you want to ask and answer in the affirmative before you proceed with that strategy. So that concludes the podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening, and the participants for leading the discussion. I'll now turn it over to JJ.
Thank you very much, Alan. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 9176. Again, the code is 9176. Please visit AILA's Web CLE Center at www.ailawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.